Well, it's great to be here, and I'm glad this many folks are here on the last day. Pleasure to be on the program, and of course, when John and Cindy called and asked about this, and the first thing I did was, you know, get a good young professor to work with you, and so Robert has graciously done a lot of the work here. We want to go with this a little bit. We did change the title to Humid Regions because originally it says Rain-Fed. But that would have taken in all those great plains, and we didn't want to go there. Now, has been alluded to in the previous presentations, the sulfur cycle is complex, and so we don't need to reiterate all of the different things that go on and have to be considered from the time of finding some sulfur somewhere in our environment to determining if it is in the plant or not and increasing our yields. When we talk about deposition, one of the things here in North America, we have these sulfate ion wet deposition maps from all over the country. And one of the things that concern me is when we look at these, it is sulfate wet ion deposition. And you see as you come into the east region over here, that we've had in 1994, much higher concentrations than you do as you go west where they have cleaner air. This is our industrial regions. But the point is, even in 94, 25 kilograms of sulfate, we were getting 8.3 kilograms of S that is coming down. When we look in 2009, that Clean Air Act really worked. And what we are down to are much lower applications or depositions, 12.5, which would be in this area here, a lot of it, we're getting about 4 kilograms of S per hectare. Now, the other thing that's happened during this time period is yields. And we pulled together these average yields from 1980, and this includes the entire country, all of the United States. So we do have the western areas with some of the lower rainfall, lower yields versus 210. If we go to corn, 5721, 9605. If we look at the removal, 8.17 up to 13.7 during that time period. If we go to cotton, southeastern region and along through Texas, Oklahoma, some of these areas, we have seen tremendous genetic input, 453 to 910. Now, the interesting thing about this is we're not removing a lot of sulfur in those yields, even though they have doubled. But if we look at the uptake that's required to grow that, we're up to about 22 kilograms of S that we need to get into that cotton. Soybean, we see a fairly large increase. And coming across, and we're growing soybeans in the further western areas. When we come to winter wheat, we see lower yields, not as great an increase when we take the entire country into effect. If we go into the eastern regions, that is the eastern corn belt east of the Mississippi, higher rainfall, humid regions, our yields would be at least four times this average. And so we're getting a lot more sulfur being taken out. So let's go back to some of the early work in the coastal plain region of the east, the Atlantic coastal plain, deep sandy soils. Dr. Gene Camperth, who many of you have studied his textbooks, I'm sure, he's done a lot of soil fertility work. When we look at these different soils, he had two sites, very deep sands, like some of the soils Mike was talking about in Western Australia. And we look at a significant response for 22 kilograms of S from calcium sulfate applied in February, but not when applied in November. We're growing winter wheat, and so we'll be planting that wheat in October and then harvesting it in late May or early June. So when we get that rainfall, our soils do not freeze, and so we are subject to quite a bit of leaching in that area. Norfolk had no response. NS ratio was 14.2 to 1. Norfolk site 2, response to 22 kilograms of S. February applications, again, were more effective. NS ratios were 20 to 1. We had some restricted root growth. If we go to work in the early 80s in Virginia, looking at corn response to sulfur, and when we talk about organic matter, Robert's going to talk about some Midwestern soils. And okay, when we say low organic matter, we're talking less than 1.5%, and a lot of them are at 1 or lower. Grain yield increases from calcium sulfate, 3 responsive sites, and sulfate acid phosphate extractable was less than 2.3. And when we looked at the yield response data there at 2 of these sites, this is a more poorly drained, the Schlegel soil on the bottom. We still see a large increase going from 8 up to almost 9.4 megagrams per hectare, with rates going up to, say, 60 or kilos. On our other soil, the Lakeland, which is a much deeper sand, again, very good yields, and it was still going up. So high sulfur response. Now, there's more of this kind of data scattered around, and the point of this is on the soils in the coastal plain, the idea is, do we use sulfur? Yes. Okay? We're not doing sulfur soil testing. We're not doing a lot of tissue testing. We're using sulfur, and we've been using it for quite a while. Again, looking at tissue NS ratios here, we see we're at 9, no increase. As you come on out here to, say, 15, we're getting around a 1 megagram per hectare. So showing the old rules of thumb that if we're below that 15-to-1 N-to-S ratio, we're certainly we're not going to get a lot of yield increase, but if we're out here in these higher NS ratios, definitely a big increase. Work by Dr. Greg Mullins in cotton in Alabama, and you see these sites. Yields going, or sulfur rates going out here, relative yields coming from 75-80% right on up. And he had more of that data. Greg also looked at these different sources of sulfur in 3 years and finding most of them to be pretty much the same, except for this 1 year when we had relatively high yields, that there was a little bit of difference. But again, what this data comes to, if we're growing cotton, we're going to be using sulfur. We're not soil testing. We're not tissue testing for it. The cost of the sulfur versus the value of the yield increase on these soils, we just use it, and we've been using it for a number of years. Sulfur recommendations, approximately 20 kilograms of sulfur per hectare, pre-plant or split with the in-fertilizer applications. Much of ours will be going out as a mixture. If you have UAN solution, we'll have either ammonium thiosulfate or liquid ammonium sulfate 8009S that's blended with that UAN solution for corn, wheat, and cotton, or we'll have bulk blends of urea and granular ammonium sulfate. Now, one thing about it is, too, is we have Mercedes factory in Virginia, Mercedes Gearhart with Honeywell. The caprolactam plant is in Hopewell, Virginia, so we have a large source nearby. But again, our ammonium thiosulfates work very well in our liquids. Elemental S pre-plant with P and K, if it's incorporated, the oxidation rates would be fairly high in our environments. We don't see that much of this being used where we are really concerned about sulfur deficiency. We'll see more of these types of products used. We are seeing the phosphorus fertilizers containing elemental S, the Micro Essentials product coming in to play now. And, of course, there are some others in that category that have not made it to our market yet. And we also, because we use quite a bit of potassium, we see a lot of blends using potassium magnesium sulfate in order to get the sulfur in a pre-plant fertilizer application. And that, of course, is an excellent source, and for some crops, potassium sulfate. Now, I want to move to a little bit of Midwest data that is much more recent, and this is John Sawyer's group at Iowa State, and they've done some really outstanding work here recently. And I was digging around through papers and looking at papers, and then For those of you that went to university before you had Google, these articles that John has prepared in the Better Crops in 2011 are the cliff notes to getting at his sulfur work. Really nice summary of the work they've done. First started seeing a lot of responses in alfalfa in the northeastern, north central part of Iowa, and you can see a check and sulfur fertilized. They got to working on this, looking at in alfalfa plant tissue increases in sulfur content, different rates of sulfur going out here, and you can see that a number of large responses in these plant tissue samples showing that he could that there was a need for this sulfur. Looking at the response yield increase per cut. Now, look at this scale, guys, 200%. Okay, these are exciting sulfur responses. And looking at the plant analysis percent S and putting a linear plateau there, even though there's some scatter around here, at 0.23 or below, you started thinking about that you really, really would get some significant yield increases. And again, that's important to recommend. And so the recommendations for managing sulfur that John has put out is low organic matter. Although if you looked at that previous slide, low organic matter, I believe, was about 2.3%. So it's not in the game as far as where I live and work for the most part. Side slope landscape positions, eroded soils, coarse textured soils. These are associated with where organic matter or topsoil has gone away. I'm bringing that association, and I'm going to show you something here. You'll say, why do I say that? Tissue samples, looking at top 15 centimeter plants at early bud, less than 0.23%. 0.23 to 0.25 is marginal. And extractable soil sulfate from surface 15 centimeters was not reliable at all, as our previous speakers have told us why. Confirmed sulfur deficiencies apply 22 to 34 kilograms of S per hectare. Coming in, then following up on these same soils, they said, let's go look at corn. And again, some spectacular results. Different counties, previous crops, soil types, silt loams, loamy fine sands. Grain yield increases here, 123 to 151 bushels per acre, 154 to 198, 88 to 108, even under a stressed condition. 196 to 204, nothing there, 96 to 172, 118 to 171, and an overall average of 129 to 167. Dramatic yield increases for corn. So John and his group immediately went to work, and this was one of the best sets of data. 45 field experiments in 2007-2008, north central to northeast Iowa. Calcium sulfate broadcast with no incorporation shortly after planting. Rates 0 to 40 pounds of S. Corn grain yield increases in 17 of 20, 11 of 25. The only place I've got responses like this is when I've done nitrogen work. You know, it's with these secondary elements, I've never seen it. And corn ear leaf tissue concentration increased at 16 sites in both years. Now, let's look at corn ear leaf percent as a critical level. Yield increase. Grandmother's birthday, I believe, Graham could go there. Yeah, it would be just like you said. Extractable soil sulfate S and extractable sulfate S yield increase, no relationship. Again, a 0 to 6 inch, 15 centimeter surface soil sample, so we understand that. Soil organic matter. Now, again, in this group, you've got some down here around 1%. But again, you know, John's in the back here, so if there's any problem with what I say about his work, I hope he'll speak up at the end. You know, I start looking, well, maybe if I really, really did something cool with the statistics. I could get something going there, but then I see all these down here. And I said, no, no relationship. And look at these pictures. I mean, the kinds of, this was a 76 bushel yield increase, 42, 20, kinds of things that as a soil fertility person you really like to see when you go to the field and do something. It's a feel-good deal. And looking at combining this data as the seven coarse textured sites here and looking at corn yield versus sulfur rate, and you see coming out here we're getting somewhere close to 20, whereas on the fine textured sites, which would not be as affected by leaching losses, we're somewhat a little bit lower, but then excellent responses. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Robert to finish up the talk.
Well, I appreciate it, Dr. Alley, and thank you, John, for the invitation as well, and Cindy. Appreciate the opportunity to come and share, and let me orient you a little bit. So Dr. Alley, up to this point, has talked primarily about the eastern coastal plain, some of the extreme eastern side of that humid region of the eastern United States, and then he's shifted gears and went completely west, the extreme western half, or the western section of the humid Midwest, and I'm going to talk about right dead in the middle of the humid Midwest, that being eastern Indiana, western and central Ohio, and then on up into Michigan. And just, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. This actually comes to me from Dr. Ron Gale when he was with Michigan State University. He had implemented quite a number of trials looking at sulfur response in a specific manner, looking at starter applications of sulfur. That's something that we do have a fair number of producers that practice that in Ohio and up into southern Michigan. And so he was interested in looking at the responsiveness across six different locations in 1 year and then five in the next year. And what I'm going to share here is six locations in 2005. We've got sulfur rate, and I hope you were appreciated the fact, as Mark went through, he kept switching units on you. I'm primarily going to stay in English units. I'm not going to be switching back and forth. So we have sulfur rate, that's on the x-axis, and we have corn grain yield, four rates that he was applying, including a 0, 5, 10, and then 20. You look across those locations, there's only one significant response. And I will say when Ron was selecting these sites to conduct this field research, he was looking for sites that were coarser texture in nature that had lower organic matter. So all of these sites had organic matter levels less than 2%, I believe, and I'd have to go back to my notes to verify that. Only one location was responsive, and it was a sandy loam soil in a no-till situation. So as we think about changes in tillage practices and increased residue left on the soil surface, resulting increased moisture level, cooler temperatures in that soil surface, does that lead to an increased need for sulfur nutrition, specifically early in the growing season? Moving on to 2006, five locations, again, a starter application of sulfur, and we have, again, 0, 5, 10, and 20. Looking across those pretty decent yield levels within 2006, still no responses in this particular year, no responses to any sulfur supplied as a starter material. So again, just orienting you to the differences as you move across that humid region of the Midwest, and we won't classify Virginia and North Carolina as the Midwest, but you get out of that east to coastal plain, we have a lot of rainfall, but we also have a lot more sulfur deposition, and we've had that historically. And we also don't have very well-drained soils. For anybody who's had any experience in that lake bed soil up in northwest Ohio, you can attest to the fact that those soils aren't very well-drained. So is the fact that we haven't seen much in the way of sulfur response into that Michigan, southern half of Michigan, is it partially explained because of the deposition amounts that we've had historically and the poorly drained nature of a lot of our soils, okay? Now, this is continuing on with some work that Ron had done. Now, I'm switching from corn to soybeans. We've got three locations, and again, Ron purposefully was selecting sites that were coarser textured soils, lower in organic matter, and pretty easy to talk about. There's only one significant response, but it's rather difficult to explain because it's not any different than the control. All right, so there was a difference between the rates and the starter formulations that were utilized, but when you compared anything to the control, there was no response. Okay. Move on to wheat, and again, as we think about where we grow wheat in western Ohio and eastern Indiana, pretty good climate for growing wheat. Our yields are quite good. Typically, state average in Ohio is in that 60-65 bushel range. It's nothing for us to hit up into the hundreds pretty easily with wheat yields. This is Dr. Ed Lentz, and I do want to acknowledge Ed. He's presently a county agent that works out of Seneca County with Ohio State University. This is actually some work that he and I have been doing, 2005, 2006. We've got two different forms of nitrogen being applied. That's urea and UAN, 80 pounds of nitrogen per acre. And then we have an additional application of ammonium sulfate with those two products. And we also have a gypsum, just comparing sources. If you look across this particular location, 2005 at Northwest, Northwest is in that lake bed soil, 4% organic matter, very poorly drained, high clay content. We don't tend to see much in the way of response. So that would be very representative of that Northwest corridor where we do grow a fair amount of wheat in Ohio. Similar results in 2006, the control where we don't supply. Now, there are some differences in here, but you have to be a little bit careful that we're comparing apples and apples. Essentially, what we selected was a lower rate of N. We actually had nitrogen response variables within these studies, so we do have higher ranges of nitrogen, so we can evaluate that if this 80 pound wasn't high enough, if we throw in an ammonium sulfate source at 20, 40 pounds, we're getting some extra nitrogen, and specifically with that UAN product, we were picking up some yield, but in all likelihood, it was due to the nitrogen we were supplying, not necessarily the sulfur that we were supplementing. Now we're going to switch gears from that lake bed soil, go more into the western half of Ohio. This is around just east of Dayton. Again, similar experimental design. We've taken out the UAN at that particular location. We didn't have any UAN for comparison. Again, no response. A lot more variability. That's pretty customary when we go from northwest to western. This particular experiment station crosses about three soil types in about 100 feet linearly, so it's really hard to lay out experiments. We get a lot of variability. Now, the other crop that we grow a fair amount of in Ohio is alfalfa. This is actually work from Dr. Warren Dick at Ohio State University. Just as a quick summary, again, he's picking locations specifically that are loamier soils, lower in organic matter. And again, it's all relative. When I say that term, lower, these sites tended to have soil organic matters less than 2.5%. Okay, you get into the coastal plain, 2.5% looks pretty good. And out of the 10 locations that the research he conducted in 01 and 02, we did have four responsive sites. So just as a brief summary as to what's being done typically in the humid Midwest and in that eastern Indiana, western Ohio, southern Michigan, we do have a fair amount of sulfur that's supplied, but we still tend to concentrate those applications and those recommendations on those coarse textured soils because we do have some sandier, some blow sands that are prevalent in northwest Ohio. Some of those do creep into northeastern Indiana. Those individuals, in all likelihood, are supplying sulfur, and if they're not, they probably should certainly consider it. So how many have been here through most of the symposium? There's, I don't know how many iterations you've seen of the sulfur cycle. This is yet another one for your graduate students. Maybe this is very helpful. You see how four different people look at this cycle. What's really interesting about the sulfur cycle is the complexity. And I say this a lot, or I said this a lot when I was an instructor at Ohio State University dealing with graduate students, specifically when we talk about nitrogen. All organic N isn't built the same, correct? It's very similar for organic sulfur. We have a very recalcitrant, very stable form of organic sulfur in that soil that's not going to be readily decomposed and result in an available form of sulfate for plant nutrition. And we also have a more reactive form, more labile form of sulfur that is highly reactive that can result in mineralization and resulting uptake by a crop. So it's just another illustration of the complexity of the system. And specifically when we start thinking about modeling or even using soil extractions or lab incubations in an effort to try to come up with potential sulfur mineralization, it's not straightforward and it's not simple. It is highly complex. It's very difficult to quantify soil mineralization. I actually haven't worked on this actively. We've done some work with nitrogen. Just from the struggles that we've had with nitrogen, I could certainly suggest that this is a true statement. And when we look at sulfur mineralization, and again, you have to look at this at some geographical scale because, again, you go from the eastern coastal plain, coarse textured, high rainfall, you're going to have to be supplying some sulfur. Extreme western, when you get into some of the work that John Sawyer's done in Iowa, at least in that north-central, northeastern corridor, he's finding some soils that are highly responsive to sulfur. John, correct me if I'm wrong, but as you move further south into Iowa, you don't see that type of responsiveness to sulfur application. So as we move forward and think about ways to generate recommendations, we've only got about 5 minutes left, and I do want to leave time for questions. Should we be looking more at a calculation of sulfur balances, looking at deposition, looking at crop removal as triggers to indicate when we should be supplying sulfur. The old rule of thumb that I've used with a lot of growers when I was with Extension with Ohio State is, do you have a history of sulfur deficiency? Have you noticed it in a particular field or soil type previously? And if you had, that's a pretty simple trigger that you probably should be supplementing some sulfur nutrition. Salient points, sulfur test for sulfur. I'm not going to touch on what Graham shared this morning. What we're currently doing doesn't seem to be a very viable way to determine specifically how much sulfur we should be. And in all reality, we're talking about relatively low rates. I think, if I'm not mistaken, University of Kentucky does utilize a critical level for sulfates soil test, but essentially it's an on-off switch. So if you're above a specific level of sulfate in that soil profile, I think it's down to a foot, if I'm not mistaken. They recommend you don't need to supply sulfur because there's an adequate supply. But if it's less than that, they don't really say, well, you should be. It's, well, we don't really know. Okay, so it's very similar for me like a PSNT. PSNT does a pretty decent job of saying when I don't need it, but it doesn't necessarily tell me how much I need to supply if it's below that critical level. And then deposition of atmospheric sulfur is declining. I think Mark illustrated that very well with the National Atmospheric Deposition Program information. Those levels are coming down, what we've traditionally gotten from our friends that work on the industrial side of our economy. They're not supplying as much sulfur to us as they had before. And it's a good idea to really continue to look at, maybe not necessarily in that lake bed soil of Ohio, at least not at this point, that we see an increased need for sulfur nutrition, but I think there's definitely some areas where we're starting to see an increase in responsiveness. Soil organic matter, and this is a great point that was brought up by Dr. McLaughlin in his presentation. I'm going to echo that point, although I don't use the 70-1, I'm going to the 101 from Tabata Bay in 2005. We could argue that point, but in all reality, what that translates into, if part of the goal of production agriculture is to maintain productivity while simultaneously having some impact on soil organic matter levels in soils, if we're building soil organic matter, the piper's got to be paid. Okay, and that's going to have to sacrifice some nitrogen, some phosphorus. It's also going to have to sacrifice some sulfur, to the tune of about 30 pounds of sulfur for every 1% increase in soil organic matter. And reduced tillage systems, and again, specifically some of the work that Ron had done, some of the things that we had done in Ohio that I didn't get a chance to show you today, looking at no-till systems with starter formulations that included some sulfur in them. From an economic perspective, if you do operate in those areas where we tend to see greater sulfur responsiveness, it's really a no-brainer with regard to application of sulfur fertilizer. If you have an increased risk of sulfur deficiency, the actual cost or the actual amount of yield required to cover the cost of that application, considering current economics, and that's subject to change in the next 45 days, you're talking about only less than a 2-bushel increase in yield required to cover the cost of that application. Future research, I think I'm about out of time. I'll stop right there because I think we do want to have a chance to entertain any questions if you do have them. Yes, Ann. Mark, did you want to touch that?
The question had to do, given the challenges with soil testing and the amount of work that needs to be done to get that figured out a little more precisely, particularly here in North America, what should we be doing? Well, my current recommendation is that tissue tests should be used. While they're not totally reliable, when we look at those NS ratios, they're not bad. When we look at some, if it's very deficient, you're going to see that. And if it's marginal, then given the economics today, you put the sulfur on. And this is what I'm seeing growers, you know, because that gross economics there with where all of our grains are being priced and the forages like alfalfa, I mean, it's just risk management.
And I would completely agree with that, Ann. And we typically use tissue testing as a diagnostic tool, but I think as you look at where we are, specifically with some of these more problematic nutrients from a soil perspective as far as measuring and quantifying and coming up with a recommendation, I think that that's a tool that's already being used by industry. I think industry is really adopting increased tissue testing. as a monitoring tool to determine just where things are. And he just left. go ahead, Mike.
The response I have to that is that my understanding is that they are looking into the chemistry and mineralogy, because in that north central and northeastern, it is a soil association that is different from other areas in Iowa. Now, the question that they also pose in their papers is, well, is this going, if you don't have sulfur deficiency now, is it coming to a soil near you in the future? And so they are working on trying to determine why that is, but as you see, the amount of work they've done so far is just covering how widespread that is. Yes, back here. So the overall comment is that in Illinois you're seeing some responses like John's group in Iowa have seen associated with various soils, but then that you go above 24-25 pounds of S, you're seeing an actual yield decrease. No, I've not seen that type of response anywhere in any of the data that's been published. And we've used sulfur particularly when ammonium sulfate will be used on forage production for warm season applications for low rates of nitrogen. 60, 80, 90 pounds of sulfur going out, and we've not seen a detrimental effect to that.
I think we better stop here and move on. So thank you very much, guys.